You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. European leaders from France, Germany, Italy, and Romania announced today their support of Ukraine joining the European Union. This comes as Russia enters the fifth month of its invasion of Ukraine and takes more control of the eastern Donbas region. Western countries, including the U.S., continue providing military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine in support of the country. But Ukrainian officials worry that support may go down as the war goes on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want this story to stay front and center here in the U.S. media? Do you want to see continued U.S. support for Ukraine? What questions do you have about what's happening there and what the future might hold? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He specializes in international security, including topics like armed conflict, foreign policy, and political violence. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Can you talk about how the nature of the war has changed? It seemed like Russia hoped to win a quick and total victory in the earliest days, and now it seems to be this grinding attrition war with lots of artillery. What do things look like now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a good capsule summary. In the opening days, they wanted to attack the major cities in the north, the capital of Kyiv and Kharkiv, the second biggest city, with these lightning strikes. And they hoped the government would fall very quickly. They would take those cities and basically from there, take over the whole country without having to do much fighting. But those initial attacks were defeated and they withdrew from those positions and they circled around and started attacking from the east. And that eastern region is where they already had some presence because they'd been supporting these so-called separatist republics in Donetsk and Luhansk. And so they came in through there and started attacking to the northeast and the southeast, linking up with their forces coming north from Crimea. And the front lines have really basically stabilized ever since, with the exception that inch by inch, bit by bit, the Russians have been making progress in that far eastern region, in the Donetsk-Luhansk area. And so we see them taking one town after another, but paying a heavy cost and inflicting a lot of damage as they go. But that's essentially where we are in the conflict.
Big picture, I want to look at war aims, what different sides want, and what that means about what an end of the war would look like. First of all, we had Vladimir Putin on the birthday, the anniversary of the birthday of Peter the Great of Russia, making a very direct comparison, saying Peter the Great, well, he didn't conquer territory. He took back Russian lands, and that's what we're doing in Ukraine. Does this give us a sense of what Putin hopes to get out of this invasion?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting and revelatory remark. There's been a lot of debate about what Russian war aims were. The more pro-Russian side saying, well, Russia felt threatened by NATO and potential membership of Ukraine in NATO. And so this is a defensive reaction in response to that threat posed by NATO and NATO expansion. And the more skeptical anti-Russian perspective saying, no, the Russians are imperialist or, you know, hearkening after their lost empire, however you want to characterize it. And Putin wrote an interesting memo a year ago, basically laying out that second position that Ukraine didn't really exist as a separate state and ought to be reunited with Russia. But a lot of people dismissed that because, of course, a lot of the Russian statements were about NATO and NATO enlargement. But this most recent set of statements is about as direct as you can get in saying, yeah, you know, we want to be just like Peter the Great and the Tsars. Russia, we want to expand and take territory. It's really our territory to begin with, so we're just taking things back that we rightfully have, etc. So drawing a direct line between himself and the Tsarist Empire of the past, which a lot of people thought he was very sad to see disappear at the end of the Soviet Union and wants to reconstitute today. So that motivation seems to be quite strong there.
From the perspective of Western supporters of Ukraine, the U.S. And Western European countries who've been sending arms, there's a lot of talk and a lot of rumors about what leaders of different countries are hoping for from Ukraine. Some saying We want to see Russia completely driven out of Ukraine, saying, well, that's going to take a long time. Maybe Ukraine should concede some of this territory. What are you watching for in that, I think, behind the scenes debate?
Yeah, I think it's mostly behind the scenes, although it comes out in public every now and then. The big debate is, well, there's, of course, the debate of, for the Ukrainians themselves, what their aims are in this war. And that's going to depend a lot on what they're able to accomplish. They would ideally like to get all of their territory back. They'd probably even like to get Crimea back, although that's a very tall order since they lost that in 2014 and the population wasn't especially anti-Russian to begin with. But they would certainly want to get back all the territory they've lost since February of this year, and probably also like to get back the rest of Donetsk and Luhansk that were supported by the Russians in these separatist regions. But then the question is, how much should the West continue to support the Ukrainians in their efforts to achieve those goals, or should we try to pressure the Ukrainians to accept less than that, indeed to make peace on terms which would involve substantial territorial losses since the beginning of the year, or even just recognize the military status quo on the ground at some point. I think the more, the less supportive countries like Germany, for instance, and even France to some extent, have been talking about the need to not humiliate Putin, which implies that Russia should get some gains out of this war. And the more sort of resolute, I would say, countries like Great Britain in this case, have been saying, no, we should support them as far as they want to go. I think a natural focal point is going to be the status quo of February of 2014, before this war started. If the Ukrainians were able to get that back, I think that would be a lesson that, aggression doesn't pay, and a great success for Ukraine. So I think the main debate now is between, should we support Ukraine to try to achieve that goal if they can achieve it with our support? Or should we pressure them to settle for something less, essentially, that grants Putin some concessions?
We're talking to Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in international security, with us for a look at the latest updates on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the military and humanitarian aid recently sent by the United States. More on the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of U.S. support for Ukraine? Do you want to see more of it or less of it? What is your answer to the question our guest just posed? Should Ukraine give up some of the territory that Russia invaded to put an end to this war or not? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your comments, or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in international security, talking about the war in Ukraine and Russia's attempts to take control of the eastern Donbas region and ongoing Western support for Ukraine. Still time for your call with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you see this issue kind of slipping from the radar in the United States? Do you worry about that, as some Ukrainian leaders do, that support might dwindle for the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. On the subject of U.S. support, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke with other countries talking about their support for Ukraine after the U.S. announced it's giving $1 billion more in aid. Here's part of his speech.
We've built tremendous momentum for donations and delivery of military assistance. And after this afternoon's discussions, we're not just going to maintain that momentum, we're going to move even faster and push even harder. We'll deepen our coordination and cooperation, and we'll bolster Ukraine's armed forces to help them repel Russian aggression now and in the future.
Andrew, what kind of support is the U.S. giving along with allies, and is it the right kind of support from the Ukrainian perspective?
The kind of support they're giving is military aid, first and foremost, artillery, ammunition, which is crucial in these eastern battles, which are, as we mentioned before, turning into these artillery duels, these battles of attrition. Also long-range rocket launchers, usable in the same sort of situation. But also interestingly, coastal defense military assistance, in particular Harpoon missile launchers. The Harpoons are these missiles capable of taking out ships at sea. And the Ukrainians have just quite recently taken advantage of earlier ones that they've been delivered to attack a Russian naval seagoing tug off the coast of Snake Island, which was so prominent in the early days of the invasion. And that's a huge deal because right now, traditionally, the Ukrainian wheat and grain supplies are exported through the Black Sea to the rest of the world, which really needs those supplies. And the Russians have been blockading the Black Sea and preventing the Ukrainians from exporting, from having shipping in the Black Sea. So if the Ukrainians could free that up, that would be a major development. So having those coastal defense forces is important. There's also a humanitarian component. I believe there's generators, medical supplies, water purification, and things like that. But those are the major items. And I think that's exactly what the Ukrainians need. The question is it enough? How much? The Ukrainians, of course, will always want more. And indeed, to really turn the tide of these battles and start going over on the offensive, they might need quite a bit more because these artillery battles are extremely resource intensive and use up a lot of material.
Andrew, some Ukrainian officials have expressed concern that their Western supporters may be feeling some kind of Ukraine fatigue, as the media maybe isn't covering the story as much as other issues, maybe domestic issues, get more high profile. They worry that people are losing interest. That could lead to support drying up. And I'll say, you know, a month or two ago, we were getting lots of calls on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now, none at 800-642-1234 if people want to prove me wrong. But is there that concern that that kind of interest fatigue could lead to a decline in support for Ukraine?
There's a concern about that, although I think it's inevitable and has to be budgeted for that. This is going to be one issue among many. It's not always going to be the only thing that gets reported and talked about. And indeed, it shouldn't be. There's plenty of other important things going on. There's the economic stories in the United States, inflation, the Federal Reserve. There's the January 6th hearings. So there's other things that are important that need to be, covered intensely. And there haven't been startling new developments on the Ukrainian situation either, having entered this sort of war of attrition, mostly static phase. So I think that's understandable. The question is, will support dry up? And they're hard to say. I mean, hopefully not, from my point of view anyway. I think we should continue to support the Ukrainians in their struggle to preserve their independence from Russia. I think the fundamentals are still sound, and you see some great signs of long-term support. I think one of the most important ones is the European Union moving, the European Union Commission in particular, moving towards placing Ukraine on a path towards membership in the European Union. This is a huge deal. Remember, if we go back to 2014, the whole reason for the Euromaidan, the protests that happened back then, was that Russia, essentially Putin, basically forbade the Ukrainians from signing a trade deal with the European Union, which he thought would place them on that path towards membership. So Russia has objected towards NATO enlargement, towards Ukrainian membership in NATO, but they've also objected towards Ukraine's membership in the EU. And if Ukraine gets in the EU, that will, I think, give it institutional ties to the rest of the European countries and will help solidify that long-term support. And also, interestingly, in terms of how Russia has scaled back its ambitions in the course of this war, not only have Finland and Sweden applied for NATO membership, which was unthinkable before this war happened, but the Ukraine now is on this path towards membership in the EU. And Putin today said that he didn't have a problem with that, essentially trying to make, put a bold face on a brave face on something that he can't control anyway. So the end result of this, even if the Ukrainians lose territory, is that Ukraine will end up as a member of the European Union, which is something that Russia was desperately attempting to prevent from happening.
have time for
So I think that bodes well.
I want to jump in and bring in a caller before we're out of time, Andrew. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hello.
Yeah, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I think not only should we equal what we're sending to Ukraine right now, I think we should triple it. I think it's a great opportunity for the United States of America to show that we still stand up for what's right. It's not going to hurt any of us. It's, you know, because the people that manufacture the weapons are going to make a ton of money. But it's still a chance that we can show that we do have some backbone left in this great country.
Pat, thanks for the call. Briefly, Andrew, how much can the U.S. escalate support without maybe getting some kind of response we don't want from Putin?
I think we can go a bit more than we have. Everyone fears, of course, the most extreme reaction, which would be nuclear escalation from Putin. And occasionally he makes remarks about that. But I have not seen a really serious nuclear threat out of Russia yet in this entire crisis, I would say. And I see very little reason to expect one, provided that we don't engage in direct war with Russia, right? If we were flying airstrikes against Russia, bombing Russian territory, that's another matter. We're not going to do that. I think we can support the Ukrainians. And if we can give the Ukrainians the tools and they can get the job done, I don't think Russia is really going to respond with nuclear weapons.
Pat, thanks for the call. And Andrew, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at possible outcomes of the Russian invasion of Ukraine as the U.S. and other Western countries continue to provide military support to Ukrainian troops. Now, a Minneapolis man pulled over in Wisconsin says police took nearly $10,000 from him, even though he was never charged with a crime. His case is an example of the burden that can fall on those who have cash, vehicles, or property seized by police. In spite of a 2018 law intended to limit police ability to seize assets from people who aren't convicted of crimes, it still happens, Rich Kramer reports.
Clifford Skinner's mom died in March. He wanted to help his father pay for the funeral, so he says he took $9,600 when he and his family drove from Minneapolis to Gary, Indiana. It was almost all the money he had, but Skinner says his father wouldn't take it. On the way home, Skinner was sleeping in the car when a Wisconsin state trooper pulled his daughter over for speeding near Osseo.
He approached me and said that he smelled marijuana coming from the vehicle. I informed the state trooper that I am a medicinal cannabis user and my doctor prescribed me that as medication.
Skinner says the trooper took less than a quarter ounce of marijuana and seized all of the money. He received municipal citations but was never charged with a crime. Still, the state patrol wouldn't give Skinner's money back. The agency told WPR it wouldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. Skinner, who is black, says his money was referred to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency on suspicion it was tied to drug trafficking. He denies that.
Guilty until proven innocent. And that's basically where I'm sitting at right now. An innocent man that got robbed by the police and been unjustly done because of my skin complexion.
Skinner's fiance, Trina Lewis, says they were saving the money for a down payment on a future house. She wasn't there during the traffic stop, but says it traumatized five of their kids who waited in a squad car as the officer searched Skinner's van for more drugs to no avail.
You know, my kids, as we see the police driving down the street, taking them to daycare, they tense up. They get worried.
In 2018, a bipartisan group of Wisconsin legislators reformed state law aimed at preventing forfeitures from individuals unless they're convicted of a crime. But there are exceptions. Money or property referred to federal agencies like the DEA can be forfeited even if charges are never filed. And state or local law enforcement can keep proceeds from those forfeitures if a person is deported, flees the jurisdiction, or doesn't claim cash or property within 9 months. Dan Albin is the co-director of the National Initiative to End Forfeiture Abuse. He calls it policing for profit.
That, I think, is highly problematic when the federal government is encouraging state and local law enforcement to not comply with their very own state laws and instead simply participate in a federal program that allows them to sidestep or circumvent those protections.
At least half of any proceeds from state-level forfeitures must go to Wisconsin's school fund. But if a forfeiture goes federal, state and local law enforcement can keep all proceeds sent back by the U.S. Department of Justice following a conviction. In 2020, police in Wisconsin reported around $775,000 in cash and property forfeitures tied to convictions. That same year, the U.S. Department of Justice sent nearly $2 million in forfeited proceeds back to agencies in Wisconsin. Skinner suspects the state patrol referred his money to the DEA in order to get a second opinion after the district attorney didn't file criminal charges. In Brown County, the sheriff's office received around $117,000 from the feds in 2020 for seizures it made. Lieutenant Matt Ronk is the director of the Brown County Drug Task Force. He says seizing assets is an important part of fighting criminal organizations, and he says his team isn't disproportionately seizing money during investigations.
But I also have a real problem leaving drug proceeds, illicit gains, predatory funds that were taken off of innocent people, innocent victims, that either by force or by victimizing them with addiction.
As for Skinner, he's hired a lawyer at an estimated cost of $4,000 in hopes of getting his $9,600 back from the DEA. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.